It was just 7 days after President Donald Trump was inaugurated. You remember.
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
When the community comes up, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
On January 27, 2017, President Trump signed Executive Order 13769, officially named Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States, and protests erupted around the country. No refugees allowed into the United States for 120 days, no Syrian refugees indefinitely, and no one from seven overwhelmingly Muslim countries allowed to enter the country for 90 days. Those countries were Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen.
This is something that 75-80% of Americans out there agree with. We don't want people that are traveling back and forth to one of these seven countries that harbor terrorists to be traveling freely back and forth between the United States and those countries.
Then Chief of Staff Reince Priebus defending the order in the days after it was signed. That first travel ban, as it came to be known, was struck down by the court system almost immediately, using the president's own words in the campaign as the basis of their rulings.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
The president and the administration vehemently denied this policy was a Muslim ban, including then Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
There are 46 other countries with Muslim populations that are not part of this. And I think that's an important thing to note. So whether you're talking about Algeria, Jordan, Kuwait, Oman, or the UAE, there's 46 Muslim majority countries that are not in the seven.
They came back with a second iteration to try and appease the courts, but that too was struck down. Then in September 2017, the administration issued a third version of the ban. And finally, today, the Supreme Court issued a 5-4 ruling on the third version of the travel ban. In a huge and long-awaited victory for President Trump, the court sided with the Trump administration, overturning the Ninth Circuit Court's attempt to place a hold on the ban.
A tremendous success, a tremendous victory for the American people and for our Constitution. This is a great victory for our Constitution. We have to be tough, and we have to be safe, and we have to be secure.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Here to walk us through what this all means is Sahar Aziz, professor at Rutgers Law School. Hi, Sahar.
Hi, Tanzina. Thanks.
So important news today out of the Supreme Court. Give us a sense of the scope of this ruling. Who is affected, and essentially, who can't come to the United States?
Well, the ruling by the Supreme Court is going to severely restrict the ability of non-immigrant visas or people who apply for non-immigrant visas from coming to the United States, particularly from those countries in the executive order, all of whom are Muslim majority country except for two, North Korea and Venezuela. And as we know, people from North Korea do not come to the U.S. due to their own government's restrictions. And the Venezuelan ban is only limited to diplomats.
This was a 5-4 decision. It was obviously on partisan lines, but we did see from Judge Sotomayor a dissent in which she says, and I quote, "Taking all of the evidence together, a reasonable observer would conclude that the proclamation was driven primarily by anti-Muslim animus." Your thoughts, Sahar?
I agree with Sotomayor, because what she did is she looked at the entire record, starting from when Trump was a presidential candidate, where he made multiple anti-Muslim statements over months, actually over a year, promising his very right-wing anti-Muslim base that he was going to keep Muslims out of America, and he was also going to attempt to deport those who were here. So she, in contrast to Roberts and the majority opinion, looked at all the facts rather than narrowly looking at the third version, which was effectively Trump's attempt to pass through an executive order that was effectively driven by religious animus.
Now, let's talk. You mentioned this was the third version of this. Can you tell us exactly how it's different from the earlier ones?
It's different insofar as it has less countries. It has Iran, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Yemen, and Chad as the Muslim majority countries. And it also added Venezuela and North Korea. Now, Chad was removed in April 2018. It's also different in terms of exempting lawful permanent residents and providing case-by-case waivers under certain circumstances. The problem is that, as the Breyer dissent shows, there are very few examples of these waivers actually being granted. In fact, he showed that only two waivers were granted in the first month and up to 430 in the first 4 months out of millions, if not at least hundreds of thousands of applications from these countries. So although the third version is more narrow, it still is driven by the same religious animus that Trump overtly expressed publicly via Twitter, via the news, via his website. And the majority essentially just put its blinders on and said, we're only going to look at the last 6 months and we're only going to look at this third version, that the language of which is facially neutral, but the motivation behind it is far from neutral.
Let's take that aside and see what the court has actually decided. Is it that the president has the authority to have this much control over immigration, or is it that he has the authority to decide when certain people from certain countries are considered a national security threat, or both?
The court has effectively stated that the president did not violate the Immigration Nationality Act, specifically Section 1182F and 1152A1A. By showing that, in fact, he can exclude these individuals or all citizens from these countries because he claims it's detrimental to the interests of the United States, and that by doing so, he did not discriminate against them based on race, sex, nationality, place of birth, or place of residence. So the plenary power, or the broad authority and discretion granted to the president in immigration affairs, foreign affairs, and national security, pre-existed this ruling. What the court did is it reaffirmed it and effectively communicated to Trump and future administrations that even if you go on the record and show that you hold religious animus, racial animus, other forms of unlawful animus, we are going to let you put forward executive orders that are at least that are facially neutral, but maybe driven by animus.
And we're also talking about the restrictions on many of these countries are indefinite and extensive. They include not just being able to come to the United States, but being able to work, study, and even vacation in the United States. Is that correct?
Correct. The executive order is going to harm students, academics, children, asylum seekers, refugees, and all people who seek non-immigrant visas or non-lawful permanent resident visas from coming to the United States and effectively benefiting the United States through their investments, through their studying, through their work, if they are from these countries and if the administration will not provide them with waivers, which the record has shown that it is not providing waivers. And in fact, as Breyer's dissent showed, the State Department has not even issued guidance to the consular officials telling them here's the criteria for the waivers. And there are some consular officials who have issued affidavits on the record in some court filings stating that this is all window dressing. And in fact, the understanding is that waivers are not granted.
Now, is this, I guess the question is, what precedent would this set for future presidents? There is a lot of concern about this administration's power over the judiciary and other parts of the executive branch. So what do you see the future implications of this being?
Well, it gives another stamp of approval that the executive can do whatever it wishes when it comes to immigration, foreign relations, and national security, so long as it provides a facially neutral language in its executive orders, and that the court will not in any way question what the real motivation is, even if that motivation is based on unlawful religious animus or racial animus. So what the court has done is given a carte blanche to the Trump administration and future administrations to discriminate, particularly against Muslims, so long as it's not stated that he's discriminating in the actual executive order. But this is a president who has gone on the record multiple times over a course of over 12 months stating his explicit animus towards Muslims and even confirmed to his supporters that when he issued the first version, that this was keeping his campaign promise that he was going to keep Muslims out of America because he believed that Islam is violent and Muslims are violent. So the fact that the court completely closed its eyes to these facts, these credible facts, is very troubling for religious freedom rights, for anti-discrimination laws, and frankly, for our international reputation as a place that prides itself in supporting civil rights and religious freedom.
Sahar Aziz is a professor at Rutgers Law School. Sahar, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. The ban means that there is a presumption that my family, just based on their religion and race and nationality, create a threat to U.S. national security.
Since last January, the various iterations of the travel ban have changed how millions of people come and go from the U.S., including people like Tara Separi-Farr and her family. We spoke to Tara on this program back in April, and we talked to her again today to get her reaction to the court's decision.
I'm very disappointed in the decision of the Supreme Court to uphold the travel ban, because in reality, nothing has changed from the first version of the travel ban to the most recent one for my family.
Tara came to the U.S. as a student from Iran in 2010. She's now a researcher at Human Rights Watch. When the first travel ban came down in January, she was a green card holder and had to cancel trips abroad. But the real impact has been on her family, who remain in Iran.
They have to prove basically their innocence through this extremely lengthy and untransparent process of a waiver visa, so they could actually come here to see their child. And several reporters have demonstrated how rare such waivers are granted to people who are flying from countries that are under travel ban.
Today, Tara is an American citizen, but she doesn't completely feel that way.
I certainly don't feel equal if I think that the highest institution in this country will not protect my rights and rights of my family the same degree that as other people.
And we want to hear from you. How are you reacting to the president's travel ban?
Hi, my name is Robert Harris, and I'm from Miami, Florida. And I am not at all surprised by today's ruling by the Supreme Court. It's stacked with conservatives, deliberately, and they're going to always vote in favor of the conservatives and their ideals. So no surprise.
My name is John Werner. I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri. My opinion is there are a lot of terrorists that are coming from these particular countries. It's not only just because they're Muslim. I have Muslim friends. I've worked with Muslim friends, and I don't have a problem with Muslims. It's the terrorists that are coming out of these countries. Trump's solution is to ban everybody coming out of the country until we can vet these people better.
This is Nikki Mohammed Fauzi from Arlington, Texas. We have just nailed the coffin of isolationism shut, and with it, the beginning of the end of the United States as a world power. The differences between us and global empires of the past was that we had diversity and inclusion and fearlessness. But since 1989 and the end of the Cold War, the baby boomer generation has worked so hard to create a replacement enemy for communism, read terrorism, that they've turned the U.S. into a fearful, weak shut-in.
And please, we want to hear what you think. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tweet us at The Takeaway. We've been covering President Trump's zero-tolerance policy for weeks now, where almost every person caught crossing the southern border had been referred for criminal prosecution. But as zero-tolerance policy has moved the majority of people to criminal courts, there's still a backlog of 700,000 cases waiting for their day in immigration court. Today, what the Trump administration's immigration policies beyond zero-tolerance mean for immigration courts in the U.S. and the people who have to navigate them. Judge Ashley Tabador is president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, and she sees the changes to immigration policy under Trump from the bench. Judge Tabador, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So, Judge, before zero tolerance, what happened when someone crossed the border illegally? When did they actually end up before a judge in immigration court?
Before the zero tolerance policies, people were generally processed through the civil immigration enforcement options for the Department of Homeland Security rather than the criminal option that zero tolerance policy emphasizes. So what that means is that people were put into immigration court proceedings and given an opportunity to raise any claims for asylum. But with zero tolerance policy, my understanding is that they are prosecuted for having entered the country without authorization first, and then determined whether or not they have a claim for asylum.
Now, I just want to clarify, because a lot of our listeners and we have seen photos of groups of migrants who are wearing orange jumpsuits who are being tried in groups. Just to clarify for those who may not be aware, those images are from criminal court proceedings, correct? And that's different from what we're talking about today.
So the criminal court proceedings under zero tolerance are completely separate and apart from the immigration court proceedings. The criminal court proceedings are before district court judges, and those are judges who have been appointed to the bench by a president and have been confirmed to that position by Senate. And they are part of the judicial branch. The immigration court is separate and apart from the district court. We are part of the Department of Justice, which is frankly one of the problems we've had to deal with, because as a court, there's an inherent conflict to be a part of a prosecutorial department headed by the number one prosecutor in the country.
Who right now is Attorney General Sessions.
Yes.
So sticking with the immigration court specifically, how many people are there in the United States today who are waiting for their day in immigration court?
Well, the last statistics that I was aware of is that it was about to hit 700,000 a few months ago, and that would mean 700,000 cases waiting for about 330 judges across the country. I believe the current numbers are upwards of maybe 715 or closer to 720,000 cases.
And I just want to make sure I have those numbers right. You said 700,000 cases, 330 judges, correct?
Yes, yes, you can imagine our daily load. Yes.
That seems like a very heavy load. And I want to ask you a little bit about whether that's going to increase, because in May, Attorney General Sessions announced new rules for immigration judges, correct?
In spring or end of March, the Attorney General announced that he would like to subject immigration judges to quotas and deadlines effective October, which is going to, in our opinion, it's going to add to the backlog because it is going to increase appeals and it is going to undermine the integrity of the court.
Let's talk a little bit, too, about the impact. Like we mentioned 700,000 cases. What is the risk of these cases not being seen or heard in time, or potentially, from what I'm understanding, sort of quickly going through these cases? Is there a risk to the person who's waiting for their day in court? It seems as though perhaps speeding the process up might benefit that person or not.
Anytime you artificially speed up the process, you run the risk of violating or in some way compromising the integrity of the case. So every case is entitled to what's called due process. And due process means that the judge must ensure a fundamentally fair hearing before the court and a decision that is limited to just the facts of the case based on the law of the land. So if you then impose some sort of an artificial time frame within which a case has to be completed, that is completely divorced from the needs or the specific facts of the case, and that is going to compromise the integrity of the case. The problem is when you introduce an artificial number. Our judges are hearing different types of cases with different demands across the country. You can have a judge maybe at a border court who's hearing 10 or 20 cases of individuals a day who do not want to fight their case because they are serious criminals. So if you have very serious criminal convictions, the person may come to court, realize after having heard what the rights and responsibilities are that it's not a case that they want to fight. So the judge can handle 15, 20 cases a day. But another judge across the country who may be hearing complex asylum cases can potentially complete just one case a day because it could have hundreds of pages of filings. It could have expert testimony, hours of hearing the person's testimony. So if you are trying to put the two judges on the same field and pretend that they are handling the same types of cases, you're seriously misunderstanding how the court system works. There is no question that our judges, every one of us is committed to making sure everyone gets due process and gets to come before the court as soon as possible. But we really cannot be subjected to these artificial quotas and deadlines because it undermines the integrity of the court. And people who come in are going to start wondering, is the judge making decisions because the judge is worried about keeping her job? If a mundane question, you know, if a routine request to continue your case is denied, are they going to wonder that it's denied because the judge is afraid that they're not going to meet a deadline? If someone's questioning is being cut off because it's not relevant to the case, will the person start arguing that the judge is doing that because they want to add another case for the day to add one more completion for the week? So these are the problems of trying to introduce quotas and deadlines instead of letting judges be judges.
Does it also impact your discretion as a judge? I'm curious about what, you know, when you get leadership, should I say, or edicts, if you will, from up high, from the DOJ, what are judges feeling about that? Is there a sense of powerlessness? Is there a sense of frustration?
The judges' morale has been the lowest in many, many years. We have, in fact, have been dealing with a lot of pressure to complete cases for a long time, because for years and years, the judges and the courts have been treated basically as second-class citizens themselves. The law enforcement have been given or have had their budgets tripled or quadrupled over the years, but the court's budget has not kept up. That's frankly one of the problems of being in a Department of Justice headed by a prosecutor, is that when budgeting has to be decided, the money first goes to all law enforcement agencies, and whatever's left is then trickled down to the immigration court. So we've seen situations where the backlog has grown and grown and grown because law enforcement has been given disproportionate budgeting to the immigration court system. So the judges have been dealing with a lot of pressures as is. And now to then be subjected to quotas and deadlines is frankly insulting, because implicit in any sort of quota and deadline is some sort of assumption that the judges need to be incentivized to work faster and do more because somehow they haven't been doing enough or haven't been completing enough cases fast enough, which is not the case.
And, you know, speaking about judges, last week we saw the president tweet, and I'm going to read you quoting from the tweet, "We shouldn't be hiring judges by the thousands. As our ridiculous immigration laws demand, we should be changing our laws, building the wall, hire border agents and ICE, and not let people come into our country based on the legal phase they are told to say as their password." Judge Tabador, your response to that?
Well, we are a democracy. We are a beacon of democracy for the world. And part of democracy is following the rule of law. And our Constitution guarantees due process for all persons who are in the United States. And due process requires that you have an opportunity to present your case before the court when you are fleeing for your life from places like Middle East or places like China, where you are being persecuted for religious, just adhering to your Christianity or religious beliefs. I can certainly understand that there is a commitment, and we're all committed to make sure that our immigration laws are being honored. But part of our immigration laws is recognizing that there is a rule of law, and democracy requires that we hold ourselves out according to the laws of our nation.
Judge Ashley Tabador is an immigration judge and president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. Judge Tabador, thank you for your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Whenever I go, whenever there's a motorcycle group, oftentimes it's a Harley, and the sound of that Harley is a little different, I have to tell you. It's really good. So thank you, Harley Davidson, for building things in America.
President Trump speaking there in February 2017, right before meeting with the CEO of Harley Davidson. That was before the president enacted steel and aluminum tariffs against the European Union, and before the European Union responded with tariffs of its own, including a 31% tax on motorcycles manufactured in the United States. This week, Harley-Davidson announced it will be shifting some production of its bikes sold in Europe overseas. According to the company, the move comes in direct response to the new European tariffs. President Trump tweeted about this yesterday, saying, quote, "Surprised that Harley-Davidson, of all companies, would be the first to wave the white flag. I fought hard for them, and ultimately they will not pay tariffs selling in the EU, which has hurt us badly on trade, down $151 billion. Taxes just a Harley excuse. Be patient." Rick Barrett is a reporter covering the motorcycle industry for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Milwaukee, of course, is home to Harley-Davidson's headquarters.
Harley-Davidson manufactures most of its motorcycles in the U.S., and that would be Kansas City, York, Pennsylvania, and the engines are made in Milwaukee, where the company has its headquarters. They also have manufacturing plants in Brazil, India, and they're opening a plant in Thailand. And what's going to happen here is that because of the tariffs that have been imposed by the European Union, Harley-Davidson has said, look, it's too expensive to manufacture the bikes in the U.S. and ship them to the EU. So instead, those motorcycles that are destined for the European Union will now be made in Brazil, India, and Thailand.
Now, is there, I mean, I've been to Europe and seen there is a little bit of a fascination with Harleys, but is there a demand for Harleys in the EU right now?
There is. The EU is actually a growing market for Harley-Davidson. It's been one of their strengths. While sales have, you know, been flat and declining in recent years in the U.S., Harley-Davidson has done well in the EU.
And we just saw a tweet from President Trump this morning. It said, quote, early this year, Harley-Davidson said they would move much of their plant operations in Kansas City to Thailand. That was long before tariffs were announced. Hence, they were just using tariffs / trade war as an excuse. Your reaction?
Well, Harley-Davidson made the announcements to open the plant in Thailand early this year, and it was well before this all happened. And what they said with the plant in Thailand is that the motorcycles that will be made at that plant will be destined pretty much for that marketplace. Because if you look at Thailand, is just one example, there's like a 60% tariff on motorcycles from the U.S. coming in there. And in other countries in Asia, tariffs can be 125% or more. So that's the reason for the Thailand plant. Originally, it was said, look, it's too expensive to build these bikes in the U.S. and ship them to Thailand. We're going to open up a plant there. So that all happened before this dispute.
Rick, you're in Milwaukee, which is the home of Harley-Davidson's headquarters. How big of a deal is this for the employees of Harley-Davidson?
It's kind of early to say yet, because what we know is that 16% of the motorcycles that Harley-Davidson makes are sent to the European Union. That's where they're destined for. So those bikes, you know, they have to be made somewhere, whether it's in the U.S. or whether it's in India or whether it's Brazil or whether it's Thailand. If you take those out of the mix from the factories in the U.S., then it's going to hurt. I mean, we don't know how many jobs could be affected yet at this point, what the impact will be, but it's not good. I mean, it definitely will make a difference at some point.
Rick Barrett covers the motorcycle industry for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks so much for being with us, Rick.
Yes, thank you.
We've been covering stories of students enrolled at for-profit universities who feel they've been scammed and the response to those alleged scams by the Department of Education. Last week, a federal judge in California ordered the Education Department to stop collecting on the loans of students who have attended schools run by the former for-profit college chain, Corinthian Colleges. Under the Obama administration, students who were defrauded by Corinthian were promised debt relief from their federal loans. Since then, at least 125,000 applications have been submitted for debt relief. But according to the Education Department's Inspector General, the Trump administration hasn't approved or denied a single claim in almost a year. Amanda Kulka is a former Corinthian College student from Boston, Massachusetts. She was enrolled at the Everest Institute and studying to become a medical administrative assistant. And she says the experience didn't match up with her expectations.
They promised me basically a better education, a better career, something that would set me up for life, take care of my son, that they would like handhold me during the whole education part and the internship, and then getting a job afterwards as well.
How much debt are you currently in, Amanda? Let's start there.
I believe about $13,000, and that's with interest. They had told me that basically they could get the loans to pay for everything, so I wouldn't even have to see anything. So they were basically saying that they could take care of that for me.
What did you understand that to mean?
What I understood was that basically everything was going to be paid from the loans. I wouldn't have to make payments, monthly payments, or have to buy my books or anything that was needed during the courses.
But you were expecting to pay them back because they were loans, correct?
Right, correct. But the way that they made it seem was that that was the only option. So later I found out that there was options that basically you would get the bill per month and then you would pay for it. I felt cheated because I didn't have all the knowledge that always should have happened before I signed those agreements.
And then in terms of the type of education you got, did you end up completing a program while you were there? And if so, what did you think of the quality of the education that you received?
I did end up completing and getting my diploma, my certification. However, the education that was offered, it was horrible. I had to teach myself. Like, they weren't supporting me in that education portion. According to their curriculum, half of the books wouldn't have been opened. I still have some of them not opened. I had to open them on my own degree just to learn the material.
When you say the books weren't opened, is it because they weren't teaching things from those specific books?
Right. It didn't match up, basically. What they were offering in the courses didn't match up to what books were offered to us. And then when it came down to the test, it didn't match up. So me having to learn from the test and basically teach myself what I was going to be tested on, but what also was all the knowledge behind that, because it was a lot of things getting covered during the course of the 9 months, but it was like a week or 2 weeks on each subject. I didn't think that was enough time to actually learn things and actually have it sit there and kind of know the job.
We want to turn now to Kirk Carapezza, managing editor of our partner WGBH's Higher Education Desk in Boston, who's been following this story. Kirk, can you help us understand what changed from the Obama administration to the Trump administration when it comes to student debt relief and how that impacts students like Amanda?
Yeah, about a year after Corinthian, which owns the Everest Institute, shut down scores of campuses, the Obama administration promised these students full relief, that is, if they could prove that they were defrauded. And most of these students who've since applied for relief were attending giant for-profit college chains like Corinthian and ITT Technical Institute, which the Obama administration said failed to deliver on the education that they had promised students like Amanda. I remember visiting the Everest Institute right after the announcement came that the school was going to shut down, and I just remember students streaming out, and most were low-income young people from Boston. They shared very similar stories to what Amanda told us, that they were promised a high-quality education and a job, and they were encouraged on the same day that they visited the campus to sign up for federal loans. And now they felt like they were left in limbo. And now 4 years later, you know, we've continued to follow these students. Many of these students are still waiting for relief.
And they're waiting for relief because these were loans that were federal loans. I mean, the government okayed these loans for what? For institutions that hadn't been certified or for institutions that weren't really institutions of learning?
Yeah, no, these schools were certified. There was a large accreditor in D.C. that right up until the day that these schools shut down had authorized these schools to grant certificates and degrees. But the Obama administration, near the end of its time in office, determined that certain schools weren't living up to these promises, that they were lying about things like graduation rates and job placement rates.
What's the situation today under this new administration and under our current education secretary?
I think it's no surprise that Education Secretary Betsy DeVos deregulated the for-profit college industry basically as soon as she took office. That was not a surprise. And last year, she ordered the department to stop reviewing these fraud claims. And then earlier this year, she proposed a new plan pledging not full relief, but what she's calling partial relief based on earnings.
And from what we understand so far, the Trump administration has not approved or denied a single claim from a former student in almost a year. Were you able to get anything from the Department of Education about that when you spoke to them?
Not much. I mean, when I reach out to them for comment, they point to an Inspector General report from late last year that shows none of these claims have been approved or denied. The department declined to comment for our story because of this ongoing lawsuit in California. Attorney Eileen Connors with Harvard Law School's Project on Predatory Student Lending, and she's representing tens of thousands of former Corinthian students like Amanda in that California court case. And here's what she told me.
To pull the rug from under these people who have already been harmed in order to save taxpayer money, that's wrongheaded. The department's own analysis showed that the new method that they've come up with would reduce loan cancellation by 80%. It's a significant change.
And Tanzina, last week, a federal judge in California ordered the Education Department to stop collecting on the loans of other former Corinthian students and to continue the Obama administration policy that would basically completely wipe their debt off the books.
So under this federal judge order, Amanda Kalka might see the debt relief she's been looking for. But under President Trump and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, there's a current proposal for partial relief. It basically says that students like Amanda would be responsible for paying 70% of their loans. I asked Amanda, would that help? Would paying just 70% instead of 100% be sufficient?
No. I mean, if I got 70% worth of education, I could understand, but I feel like I got no education. It's taken me so long even to get into a repayment because it comes between buying food for my son or paying student loans, and I'm a mom, so I have to take care of my son first.
Our thanks to Amanda Kalka for sharing her story and Kirk Carapezza, managing editor of our partner WGBH's Higher Education Desk in Boston. All this hour, we've been hearing from you, our listeners, on everything from immigration to leadership in this country.
My name is Mara from St. Louis, Missouri.
Chase from Groton, Connecticut.
This is Anne calling from Minneapolis.
This is Mario calling from Honolulu.
And we want to hear you in that mix. To add your voice to the conversation, just text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates do apply. And you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, START. Text us 69866 and we'll send you a few text messages a week about topics we're discussing on the show. And who knows, you might even end up on air. Plus, you can always find us on Facebook and leave us a comment there. And of course, call us 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega and this is The Takeaway.